verses. Braxton and Mr. Borland.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'd like to limit my arguments to the pat down, ineffective assistance, and the speedy trial issues, unless the court wants to ask me questions about one of the other issues. We'd suggest to the court that the appellant's Fourth Amendment rights were violated when a pat down occurred. There was no indication to the police officers that the defendant was armed and dangerous, that he had any drugs. I think there are a number of cases that hold that just stopping an individual who is a passenger, it's not enough for a pat-down. Now, in part of its argument, the prosecution states that the appellant was just looking forward as to say that that's a ground for a pat-down. Now, what is...
Search pat down was based upon the fact that the officer believed that the defendant was armed and dangerous. He found instead that it was followed naturally from the fact that there was a criminal activity being suspected. But that's not the basis on which you can do a pat down search. It isn't sufficient. Indicate.
I'll go there. That's fine.
Well, I'm not questioning going there. The question is, where do we go from here? That would seem to say we need to send it back to the trial court and make that additional determination as to whether there's a fact or that it's wrong. If you go back and look at the court judge's actual statement, there. I can't hold them down in light of what the law is. It's actually a two-step process. You remember the first one is, really didn't go there. And I'm not saying the facts wouldn't support it, but isn't that be enough at least for you to go back? And whether that helps you or not, I don't know.
I think it might be enough to go back, yes.
Of course, with an affirm of district court on any basis, alternative basis. When you read the district court's opinion, taken as a whole, is it fair to conclude that the district court felt that the officer's safety was at issue under the circumstances here?
I disagree. I don't think it was. He has no knowledge of this particular appellant. There's nothing in the testimony that he thought...
That's not a requirement that the officer has knowledge of a particular appellant.
I think it's a point. I'm not saying it's the only point that the officer could consider. But he knew somebody had been convicted of having a gun before when he made the stop or recognized the person. That might be a ground. I think, and if I can go one step further, the fact that he was looking ahead, that's certainly not a ground. I mean, what is somebody supposed to do? If they move around, they'll say it was a furtive gestures. And if they protest too loudly, you'd say that, well, there's something to hide. So I don't see any grounds for the pat down.
Well, the car was stopped because the wrong license plate was on there. Judge Quarles found that specific fact doesn't follow the car could have been stolen and the man was on.
I agree that there was a grounds for the stop, but not for the pat down of this person. He wasn't the driver.
Well, that focus that see you going there. It's agree with the practice. This district court was very specific in saying that the suspicion that the defendant may have been involved in the theft of the car was sufficient based on the very first test. That's wrong. You've got to have more. And not only that he was armed and dangerous, there is a reasonableness determination, which I'm all in favor of our court going, and if the evidence shows it and the officers testified for it and enough in it for us to pull this out, but
I'm not sure we're in the position to make that additional determination of whether it's reasonable.
Well, I
asked when you started out talking about the evidence, do you need to go there if this particular district court judge has made it very clear with his basis? And that's wrong.
I agree it's wrong.
Well, if we do take up the evidence here, the probable cause to stop the car, you've got both bad tags belonging to another vehicle, and you've got tinted windows. How many people were in the car? Four?
I think at least four.
At least four. And I think it's fair to say that the danger to police is enhanced as the number of persons in the car rises. I don't place perhaps as much emphasis on the fact that the policeman said he saw the suspect was nervous and it was in a high crime area. But when you have tinted windows, four passengers, bad tags, it seems likely that the officer was simply trying to take a precautionary measure so that he would not be shot. There's a risk here, and if we pull the reins too tight, that we may require officers to take chances with their safety and their lives. And it's a relatively, I won't say it's small precautionary measure, but it's not the most intrusive thing in the world, and just an ounce of prevention in some cases may save, may prevent a real tragedy from unfolding.
Isn't there a difference between asking to leave the car and patting them down? Wouldn't having them leave the car
But this wasn't and if this were a traffic stop, I mean, I think a lot of it is in the nature of the traffic stop. If this were a traffic stop of speeding, or that somebody has a rear light out, that to me is a different thing. And I wouldn't favor. I agree with Judge Wynn. I wouldn't favor an automatic rule. I wouldn't go that far, but I do think evidence is always important. And when you have tinted windows and bad tags, that's a little more sometimes. And you have the number of passengers that were here and the area in which the stop was here. I just, at the bottom line, I just wonder if we are requiring police officers by the side of the road, and those can be very, very volatile situations, and they can escalate very rapidly. And requiring officers to take a greater measure of risk with their personal safety and conceivably their life.
Well, I think
here there was an arm. You know, here in fact there was a weapon. Suppose it had been used.
That's after the fact, isn't it? And it doesn't the case law hold that there has to be some kind of reason behind it? And is the fact that the driver of the vehicle had false tags, is that enough to infer that upon the passengers? Well, I'd suggest it doesn't.
Suppose that weapon had been used.
Well, couldn't anybody have a weapon in a car? I mean, anybody can. So do you do that for everyone?
Well, I'm agreeing with what folks say in terms of our evidence view. The Johnson case said
whenever you have a traffic stop, talk with things police officers. And but I'm not even sure we need to go there, because that's not what you have here. What you have is a district court who says that that press was okay because criminal activity was suspected. Johnson case made it clear that the first determination you make is to determine whether to stop illegally. If you want to further pat down a passenger, you have to determine whether there is a reasonable suspicion that he's armed and dangerous, not done here. And so while I'm in agreement with Judge Wilkerson in terms of how I would view the evidence, possibly I probably would say the same thing if it had been made, but it just wasn't made here. And that's the problem I'm having, is even in arguing where you're going with this, is it necessary? Because that's not what this case is about. And I'm not even sure you can read the district court orders to import anything, because he says it right on the record. That's all I think is necessary. That's it.
No, I think it's wrong. I agree. May I go on to my other topics? I see I only have a little less than 4 minutes to go. Unless the court has any more questions about this particular topic.
Oh, you're the master of your
own. Okay, the second prong on this particular thing is that the prosecution said that another crime was committed. And that's why, even if the court finds that there was no probable cause, I don't agree with that. He was never charged with resisting arrest, and it happened simultaneously. It wasn't like some of the other cases where they run or something of that nature. So we suggest that that's not ample grounds. On the ineffective assistance, we'd suggest that the attorney, who's a public defender service, didn't go far enough. Here's a guy who's in charge, who's facing a career criminal.
You should ask him to find if ineffective assistance on part of the lawyer you might have some good advice. Rather unusual, wasn't it?
Not in this case. He provided advice based on a discovery that he didn't turn up. It was lousy advice because under the circumstances. Because if it had been what he thought, that it was found that the police officer did this search without finding out this information, then chances are pretty strong the suppression would have been granted and he would have walked. So I don't see anything wrong with that argument. The last argument concerns the speedy trial. Oh, and on the second argument, I think if the court found that, the court could have enforced the plea agreement. But on the last argument, the speedy trial.
I've been looking at speedy trial arguments for a long time, back when I was in the military, CMO. I haven't seen one of those things go in a long time, so I'm going to be really interested to see who you go with.
All right, well, you're going to find out within the next 2 minutes, I hope. This guy was languishing in state court when they knew what his record was. And they just let him stay there for months and months and months. As soon as he's arrested, they check it. He said, oh, he's got these convictions. Then they decide district court, a federal court, or state court. Well, they just let him sit there. I think in looking at the overall situation, you have to look at the overall situation. So I don't think it should be excluded. It should be a factor that the court considers. And then they put him in, they try him, they're looking for somebody, or they finally indict him. This witness isn't here. And then they say, okay, he's not here, dismiss the case, and supposedly the same day they indict him again. So it starts all over. I mean, are they permitted to do that ad infinitum until the statute of limitations comes up? I suggest not. And I suggest that under the circumstances that they violated his speedy trial rights. And also they rely and say, well, this was we filed a motion, so it stopped. Well, isn't a motion supposed to be for complex cases? I mean, this is a very uncomplex case. A car was stopped and they searched him. This isn't a conspiracy with a multi-co-defendants or some other complicated issue. This is a simple issue, and the speedy trial clock shouldn't have stopped in a case like this where a motion is filed because it wasn't complex.
Didn't he file all kinds of motions? I mean, wasn't the trial delayed because he was filing a flurry of motions and wanted new counsel? He wasn't happy with his counsel. And then I thought another reason it was delayed was because of the, maybe the government thought it was convenient, but one of the critical witnesses was in Iraq. I mean, there seemed to be some good reasons why there was excluded time here.
I see my time's just about up. Can I answer this question? Okay. I don't think it's his fault that he asked the continuance because he believed his counsel was ineffective. How are you going to go to trial with somebody when you think he's ineffective, and if he was ineffective? And the second reason, if their witnesses isn't there, isn't it correct that that's also not his fault? He didn't file that motion. So why can the prosecution do that? Why should they be able to do that? And
you can still have excluded time if the prosecution files a motion, which is in good faith and for a good reason. That's still excluded time. If somebody can't take it because they're in Iraq, and you try to make those kinds of accommodations, service personnel, who are you going to? Falling back from Iraq, have whatever disruption his return to the United States is causing the military there. I mean, I'm not sure that would be a great question.
May I answer this question also?
No, you don't have to wait on your bus for that. We let you go over. Mr. Hanlon?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michael Hanlon, Assistant U.S. Attorney on behalf of the United States. The government does believe that the judgment of the District Court, both as to the motion to suppress, as to the speedy trial matters, as to the sentencing and all of the other matters in this case, should be affirmed. And I will begin, as defense counsel, with addressing the Fourth Amendment issues, which, of course, the Court has already asked various questions. I'll start with the Court's ruling on the issue. It had been my intention, frankly, to discuss facts and the evidence, but I gather from the Court's questions that I think the Court's ruling is probably the place to start. At page 30 of the record, Judge Quarles made his observations about the reasons for the denial of the motion to suppress, and I do agree that there is no explicit statement here about armed and dangerousness. Those terms do not exist, do not appear in the transcript. In fairness,
that the defendant may have been involved in the theft of a sufficient basis for the murderous passage. And this is preceded by language that talks about the reasonable suspicion of criminal activity committed to prison passage. The lack of the tag on the vehicle is an appropriate basis for the stop. That's it.
That's correct.
I'm not saying the evidence in and of itself wouldn't support something different. This is what the Court found. And I think it is clear the statement that that's a sufficient basis for a frisk. That's not right, is it? That in of itself is not right, is it? That criminal suspicion, criminal activity alone is not enough to pat down a passenger. I just don't think it's enough.
That is correct, Your Honor, except unless that suspicion of criminal activity is just, and I have to add some language here, and it's language
sure.
I sort of inferred.
If you do so, use the Johnson case to do it, because that's where I'm getting confused. It used to be pretty much on point.
The
Johnson case goes into the whole gambit of it. It even talks about how, and I agree, you know, if we could just hold per se that any time an officer pulls someone over in this kind of a neighborhood in a bad situation, oh, that common sense tells you that's the safety situation right there. That's not the law, though. The law says you can stop them for criminal activity, but if you want to pat them down, you have to have a reasonable suspicion that they're armed and dangerous. That's what the trial court did make. Make that determination.
That term doesn't exist. I inferred from the court's comment that the suspicion that the defendant may have been involved in the theft.
You inferred a reasonable suspicion.
I did infer that it was a reasonable.
But I don't even think we can do that. I don't even think this court can make that determination of reasonableness. That's a trial court determination.
Respectfully, Your Honor, assuming for the moment that Judge Quarles' judgment or his comments here didn't imply that when he talked about suspicion, there was suspicion of dangerousness and a weapon, it seems to me that under this court's precedence that a judgment can always be affirmed on alternative grounds clear from the record. seems to me that based on the evidence in the record,
my good colleague is just absolutely right about the fact that you don't automatically frisk passengers after the fact. That a frisk does require more than a suspicion that criminal activity requires that someone be on the road. And I think, on that proposition, the question is whether district court would be required to say the magic words. And sometimes we come with situations where a district court doesn't actually say the magic words, but the circumstances make clear that the court did believe it was a dangerous situation as well. And so the question is, when you look at what the district court did find, what he did, you take a totality of the circumstances approach, which a case like Illinois v. Gates and many others would require us to do. And you put together the fact that this wasn't a routine run-of-the-mill traffic stop, that you're in a dangerous area, it's a roadside situation, that the police are outnumbered, it appears, until backup arrives, by the number of people in a car. That we're talking about tinted windows, we're talking about bad tags, we're talking about a high crime area, and we're talking, I think, about a police perception of nervousness on the part of the person that was frisked. Now, were all of the passengers frisked here?
It seems clear from the record, Your Honor, that as the officer on the – I think so. As the officer on the passenger side was dealing with the defendant, Mr. Braxton, who was on the front passenger side, I think there was testimony in this case that the officer on the driver's side was in the process of beginning a pat-down, or was about to begin a pat-down to the driver. I believe that's the case.
Okay. But there was testimony about this particular passenger being nervous, and a gun was indeed found on it.
That's right.
And, these are judgments that have to be made on the spot. They're made under very pressured circumstances. An officer doesn't have the leisure to debate this kind of thing. He's on the side of a road. He probably feels some apprehension. Given these circumstances, I know I would feel a good deal of apprehension. I wouldn't just feel, well, there's no danger in this situation. There's no problem with it. It turns out later that the officer had good reason to feel a bit of apprehension. But, it boils down to me to the fact that I just don't want to shave it too tight where somebody's life and safety can be on the line. And so the question is, can you, even though the magic word should have been said, even though the last I should have been dotted and the last T should have been crossed, can you still gather from the combination of these circumstances that the officer had reason to believe his personal safety, and perhaps even his life, was at risk?
That is the government's view of what the evidence showed. And again, I don't want to read the district court's mind.
But that's what the district court, that's the evidence the district court credited.
Yes, sir.
But he didn't find.
I'm sorry.
But he did find. That's not the basis upon which you rely. And I agree with my good friend, Wilkerson, these are magic words. These are not my magic words. These are from the United States Supreme Court. It says it very explicitly in Johnson. Justify a pat-down of a driver or a passenger on a traffic stop. However, just as in the case of a pedestrian, reasonable must suspect that he's armed and dangerous. It is not an onerous burden on the part of a trial judge or prosecutor to honor the Constitution of the United States and to enforce the law as the Supreme Court indicated it should. All he had to do was make the finding in the order. I don't say you can't do it now, but he just didn't do it. And I don't think even you in upholding your position, I don't think there's anything wrong with you just saying, hey, Judge, this is the way it's done. And I agree with everything. If I'm the fact finder of this thing and I'm asked to go look at this evidence, I can extrapolate everything that's been said. That's a dangerous situation. Everyone is. And there have been statutes enacted in states to deal with dangerous situations, some of which recognize that individuals are often stopped and they perceive this as a common sense phenomenon. Dangerous situation. I can enumerate a number of them. It's not exactly the way it ought to work. We have to use specific, objective ways by the word reasonable suspicion. While all these things are there, we cannot do today to determine whether that is reasonable in this case. And if it's done, then when it comes up, the review is pretty much straightforward in this level. But it's got to be done.
I agree it has to be done, Your Honor. And I agree that if remanded, the government will probably seek with the district court to make that record. Respectfully.
Nobody's more for police officers in terms of wanting protection than all of us here. I mean, we all like to be protected. And we do not want anybody to be put in a dangerous situation. But this isn't asking you to be put in a dangerous situation. It's simply asking the trial judge to make the finding in accordance with the law. And he says the only basis upon which this was done was that it was criminal activity afoot, a suspicion of it. That's not enough. It's clearly wrong in light of the Supreme Court decision.
If that were explicitly what the district court had said and meant,
well, read yes. It.
I think it's got to be a two-pronged sort of analysis.
We can look at this order, but he has a whole paragraph of it, and that whole paragraph that deals with that says that explicitly.
It says
it right there. It says the suspicion that the defendant may have been involved in the theft of the car was a sufficient basis for a terrorist risk test, and nothing else. Not one word in this is about being armed and dangerous or fearful of safety or any of that. Nothing is here.
And
you've got to have it.
It would be better if – it would
not
be easier
better.
For me.
It is necessary. The Supreme Court says he has to have it. He has to. You, this is enough to stop the vehicle. Clear. It's enough. You believe the fact you got traffic violation, enough to stop. But to pat down a passenger is a little bit more. You just don't stop a vehicle and pat down a passenger because he's got bad tags on the car, or because Reynolds are headed, which he might not even be the passenger's car, you got to suspect he's armed and dangerous, or some fear of his safety.
That is the standard.
Which is not here.
Because there's no disagreement about the standard.
Yes.
The question is, and I don't think there's really any great deal of doubt as to what the district court would do upon remand. But the question is, how can this situation not be dangerous? How could it be other than dangerous? If just taking into account the common sense, if any one of us in this room found ourselves in this situation, we would be silly not to regard it as dangerous. Every person in this room when confronted with the situation of the confronted would find that to be a dangerous situation and would want to take some minimal precaution to protect their own safety and their own life.
Let me change the direction. We're headed in Judge Wynn's direction. Assume the attorney was sufficient in his performance by the but the defendant got a fair trial. Would that be an error?
Assuming the trial was fair, but there was a finding that there was deficiency with respect to the plea agreement, there is some case law that suggests under certain circumstances that the government could be compelled to enter into a plea agreement It hasn't been briefed in this issue to the best of my knowledge because the party sort of focused on sufficiency and prejudice. I think that the prejudice prong would probably still play in, assuming for the moment that there were deficient performance by counsel in terms of his argument, and assuming for the moment that he should have done investigative steps. It seems clear from the record in this case that that was not what motivated Mr. Braxton to go to trial. And this is an area where I think Judge Quarles, in his memorandum opinion, did make comment that there was advice to the defendant to accept the guilty plea. And the testimony certainly seemed pretty clear to the defense counsel that the defendant's reason for rejecting that plea were because all of the pleas had been simply for too much time. He didn't want to do the time. So even assuming that there was deficient performance, the government would argue under the prejudice problem that the standard under Strickland and his progeny has to show the trial was fair, the defendant made his decision.
But the point is that is the ineffective assistance of counsel a trial right? If in many instances you have an ineffectiveness claim and there's no trial afterwards, and somebody just comes up 3 years later and say, this was an effective assistance and I entered into a bad place. The thing that makes this different is that there was a trial. Let's say there was a fair trial. We find no error in the trial. And we then look behind the trial and find ineffective assistance, or is ineffective assistance primarily a trial right?
I hate to say I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not sure, only because most of the cases are the converse with the court just made. I've never been – I can't remember when I've been presented with a situation like this one. They do come up
– There was still allegations. The trial was not fair.
Oh, none whatsoever. None whatsoever. Not on brief, and as near as can be told, the trial itself is quite fair. There's been no allegation in this field that was in sufficient form.
So does that go to an absence of prejudice?
I think an argument could be made there, Your Honor. Of course, we focused on the defendant's position, but the fact that he got a fair trial at the end of the day certainly seems to indicate that his Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights were vindicated in the end. He had a good lawyer representing him for a fair trial. I think the argument could be made candidly. It's not a matter of research here. And our focus on Hill versus Lockhart and his progeny
was the ineffective assistance of counsel here. I mean, counsel, I encouraged him to take the deal. And if he found the, and we seem to be blaming counsel for doing two things. Number one, for giving good advice, and number two, for not finding inculpatory evidence.
Correct.
Which would have only hardened the government's position. The more inculpatory evidence you happen to come upon, the worse deal you're going to get.
Correct.
From a defendant's point of view. So it seems kind of an odd, an unusual claim. I've seen ineffective assistance. It's probably the most omnipresent claim in the entire criminal justice system, and I've seen it come up in every sort of form and configuration imaginable. But it is a little unusual to blame counsel for giving good practical advice and for faulting him to say he didn't uncover inculpatory evidence.
It is an unusual posture, that's correct. The converse will be what we see, which is why the government submits there was no ineffective assistance.
Step back is most likely the other issue, like when it comes to vision. You've got to assume the vision will be given, except for your own opinion. And then he's upset that he's saying he got bad advice on it. But the defense counsel testifying is naturally. Nobody's going to get up and say, I told differently, I would think. And you really only have his word against the defendant. So you've got opposing interests here. And I think the defendant is trying to get you, wants you to step back and say, wait a minute. Here I am in a situation, and if you can't find this other part of the safety, you're not going to be able to convict him. And he didn't make that up. I don't think that he had to. Order that person couldn't figure that one out. And the government offers you just the sweetest deal in the world. So that was a very sweet deal he was offering. And, I can only imagine the defendant in that perspective. I'm not sure the average one can just by himself conclude,
oh, I shouldn't take that. I should try to get the nothing because I've got to get convicted. That's kind of where it's going. But you know, I think when you step back at the end of the day, when you're looking at the review of this matter, that's not our job. I mean, the trial judge has a basis on making that determination, as counsel said, which is, of course, the matter that you wanted. But yeah, that has to be the basis of it, is that, you know, the defendant's trying to get you to say, wait a minute, you know, I would have taken this deal if you told me I could be convicted on this stuff and given me advice that, hey, possibly you can find it, or I'll just make another determination, and I would get this much longer sentence. But somewhere along the line, someone told me I could get nothing. I can get nothing as opposed to 5 years. I'm going to do that as opposed to putting myself on this for you.
That was the defendant's claim, yeah.
I think, you know, it all flows. It's unfortunate to him. That's the evidence is put out. The trial judge has the discretion to believe others and not believe others' credibility, and that's where it is.
That is, I think, where it is. Respectfully, in this instance, yes, I do agree. The final issue, and my time is close to the end, was, of course, the speedy trial matter that was raised on brief today, and I'll address any questions the court has. The government would certainly submit that both statutorily and constitutionally, the speedy trial requirements of federal law were upheld in this case as being a speedy trial violation. Unless the court has further questions, I'm asking.
I asked one more question. It wasn't as if the lawyer didn't make an attempt to retrieve that.
Your Honor, my time is about to lapse. May I have leave to respond? I think the record is clear that counsel made substantial attempts to retrieve that.
It might also be a different case if he's done nothing, but he tried to get there.
He asked the government, and government counsel at the time was under the same impression he was. There were substantial attempts to find stuff if he found a CAD report. It seems clear he did a thorough
investigation. From the Strickland, he tried to get that out. It wasn't his fault.
Absolutely not.
But he tried. That's not ineffective system when you make that kind of an effort. And from a prejudice point, you know, if the government had turned over the evidence, it would have been a lot tougher to eat.
I would agree with
that. You know, the way these bargaining sessions go, a lot of it depends on confidence. The lack thereof is what it can do and how easily and quickly it can do it. Forward here.
That's been my experience.
Well, I'm just not sure how the performance stages along much of that goes. Yeah.
Agreed. If there are further questions, thank you.
We'd like to hear from you in rebuttal.
First, to answer your question about should they have brought him back from Iraq, I think the answer is yes. Government planes go back and forth from the United States to Iraq. Prosecutions often ask for questions where they don't even know where a witness is. This time they knew him. They chose not to bring him back. As far as the ineffective assistance is concerned, they could. It's the same government. Well, it's the same United States government. They could have made requests to bring them back. They could have.
I mean, how do we know what he's doing?
How do we know what he's not doing?
Suppose he's in some operation in Fallujah. He's, you know, he performs an important role in that operation. He's supposed to just yank people out.
Well, suppose he got shot. Wouldn't they put somebody else in there?
I'm not sure if that's particular.
Well, I mean that's my position. If I could go into the speedy trial, not the speedy trial, but the ineffective assistance. The fact that the trial may have been fair, I don't think that's really the point. Suppose that you had a fair trial and the defendant said, hey, look, I got an alibi. I got three witnesses. They're going to all say I was at point X, not at point Y. and the defense counsel doesn't bother to contact them and bring them to court. Wouldn't that be ineffective assistance? And I think it's the same in this instance. If you find that he didn't do enough, if you find that he could have maybe he could have gotten his I'm asking you to. I think that isn't this a de novo situation? Can't the court make those findings?
Do you think we can make the findings de novo?
Yes. If this was a public defender, he had resources. He could have gotten investigated, go there and try to make sure.
You will recognize that.
I will. And if the court finds that those that those efforts are enough for
We're going to find them. We don't need to have an evidentiary hearing.
There wasn't an evidentiary hearing.
What?
There was an evidentiary hearing. I mean, if the court finds that what he did was not enough for ineffective assistance, then the rest doesn't flow. I agree.
I'm just a little bit perplexed with both the opponent's prong and the prejudice prong. The prejudice prong, you have two difficulties. Number one, as far as I can determine, the trial was fair. But before you even get to that point, you have a prejudice prong of whether it's in the government. The more inculpatory evidence that the government may have had, the worse deal you get. And that's just a prejudice point.
Well,
you can say, well, we would have taken the deal then, but it might not have been a very good one. I'm talking about probability.
Who's to say that if the defense counsel made the appropriate effort, he would have gotten this tape and the prosecution wouldn't have known about it and the offer would have still been on the table? That's certainly a possibility. It doesn't automatically mean that if he gets the tape, the prosecutor will get it also, if those efforts were made. So there's some ifs. It doesn't mean I can't argue the ifs. The last rebuttal point I want to
make. Lawyers love that word. I don't blame them.
The last point I want to make is concerning the search and the fact that the defendant was looking forward. I don't think that's enough for a reasonable police officer to determine that he was nervous or acting inappropriately.
Not all.
Well, I think that's a big issue. So I think so.
Right.
There's nothing else?
All right, we'll come down and